Again, we'd like to turn to Song of Solomon, chapter 8. Again, we'll look at this question in verse 5. Song of Solomon, chapter 8, verse 5. The question is asked as a result of the charge that she gave to the daughters of Jerusalem. So I believe we can assume that the daughters of Jerusalem are asking the question, "Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved?" Again, all through Song of Solomon, we see two main characters, a man and a woman, a bridegroom and a bride, if you will. And these two are in love and communion with one another throughout the various scenes of the book. And there are many different scenes in the book. And what we've read here, of course, is a question asked, I believe, by the daughters of Jerusalem. I suppose it really doesn't matter who asked the question. As we said this morning, it's not a question of for the purpose of information or identity. It's more an expression of wonder, astonishment, and puzzlement. Who is this? The tone of the question is indicative of the fact that this woman is looked at as very strange. She's not normal. She's not the usual. From the question, we see the direction of this woman. She cometh up from the wilderness. And again, it's present tense. It's what she is doing. She's ascending. She's ascending from and rising above the wilderness. That needs to be descriptive of you and I. That needs to be descriptive of the Lord's church. So we see that this woman is noticeably different. The daughters of Jerusalem notice that she's different. She's different in her character. Her movement is different. Her life is different. In this message, we want to notice some things about her that made her different. Well, we want to stress that it was these differences that enabled her to rise above the wilderness. It was because of these differences that she was able to rise above the wilderness. Again, the wilderness is a picture of the world. An individual does not just determine one day, "I'm going to quit being worldly. I'm going to start coming up out of the wilderness." Determination alone will not produce a continual, ongoing coming out of the wilderness. Determination alone will not mean that we're going to be separate from the world. So I want to speak tonight on how to be rising above this mess. And again, this is something continual, something that we ought to always be doing. Again, who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? That needs to be us. That needs to be us right now. So why was she able? What was it that enabled her to come up from the wilderness? Again, determination alone isn't going to do it. I guarantee you, if you just sit here and you determine in your mind, "You know what, I'm going to live above the world," you're going to fail. It's going to take more than a determination to do so. First thing we want to notice, the love of her life. Again, this woman is distinct from the wilderness. And the direction she is moving is astonishing. The foundation or root of her distinctness and her direction is seen in the words, her beloved. Her beloved. That's foundational. She constantly refers to him as the love of her life throughout the book. In chapter 1, verse 7, we hear her say, O thou whom my soul loveth. O thou whom my soul loveth. Chapter 1, verse 13, she refers to him as my well-beloved. My well-beloved. She refers to him 23 times as my beloved. Three times she refers to him as my love. So we hear her say, O thou whom my soul loveth, my well-beloved, my beloved, my love. These words speak of something very real to her. They're not just words. They are reality in her life. And if we are going to be rising above the mess of this world, our love for the Lord must be real. Nothing less will do. Our love for God must be real. Again, and we're going to repeat these words throughout the message. O thou whom my soul loveth, my well-beloved, my beloved, my love. Those are not shallow or empty words. There's a depth in those words. It is something that consumes the heart. It's something that consumes the mind, and it's something that consumes the life. And if we're going to be continually rising above the mess of this world, our love must be deep. It must be real. It must be deep. A love that reaches the soul. A love that reaches our innermost being. O thou whom my soul loveth, my well-beloved, my beloved, my love. You notice in those words there is not a hint of uncertainty about them. Not a hint. Her love for him is certain. There's no question in her own mind concerning her love for him. And if we are going to, again, be rising above the mess of this world, our love for him must be absolutely certain. Rock solid. Deep. Real. O thou whom my soul loveth, my well-beloved, my beloved, my love. There's emotion in those words. There's great emotion in those words. Her love for him did not leave her emotionally detached from him. Love does not do that. Love does not leave you emotionally detached from the one that you love. Someone will say, well, I'm not a very emotional person, therefore I'm not emotionally attached to my wife or my husband. That's baloney. Love has an emotional attachment. Love does not leave you emotionally detached. So our love for Him, if we're going to live above the mess of this world, our love must not just be a love of words. Our love for Him must consume our heart, our mind, and our life. Again, O Thou whom my soul loveth, my beloved, my well-beloved, my beloved, my love. Her love for Him was in the present tense. It was also in terms of, it's personal. It's very personal. O Thou whom my soul loveth, my well-beloved, my beloved, my love. It's personal. It's a personal experience. And all through the book, we see that she has personal experience of Him. Notice in verse 14 of chapter 1, my beloved is unto me, that's personal, has a cluster of camphor in the vineyards of Engedi. Notice in chapter 2, verse 8, the voice of my beloved. She knew His voice. This is personal. The voice of my beloved. Verse 10, my beloved spake and said unto me. My beloved spake and said unto me. Again, this is personal. Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. Verse 16, my beloved is mine, and I am his. This is personal. Chapter 5, verse 2, I sleep, but my heart waketh. It is the voice of my beloved. Again, there's personal experience that knocketh, saying, open to me. Open to me. So this is a love that is very personal. In verse 4 of chapter 5, my beloved put his hand by the hole of the door. My bowels or my heart were moved for him. Chapter 6, verse 3, I am my beloved's. My beloved is mine. Again, very personal. Chapter 7, verse 10, I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. If we're going to be rising above the mess of this world, our love for Him must involve personal relationship with Him. We can't just have someone tell us, you love the Lord. And you grow up hearing that, you love the Lord. It has to be personal. In order for it to work, in order for it to be strong enough to lift you out of the world, it has to be a personal love, a personal attachment to the Lord. Her love for Him was fervent and intense. We see that in those words, O Thou whom my soul loveth, my well-beloved, my beloved, my love. And if we're going to be rising above the mess of this world, our love for Him must be one that cannot be contained. If our love for Him can be contained, then it's not that great of a love. If our love for Him can be hid, or if you would even have a desire to hide it, It calls into question the very fact of love. So if we're going to rise above this world, we need a love that cannot be contained. Something we cannot hide. When she spoke those words, O thou whom my soul loveth, my well-beloved, my beloved, my love, she was stating her priority in life. My well-beloved. She's stating her priority. O thou whom my soul loveth. She is stating the priority in her life. In other words, her love for him was a love that exceeded all others. He was priority. He was first. He was the center of her interest. He was the focal point of her life. He was the meaning of her life. What I mean by that is her motives, her purposes, her viewpoints, her goals, her desires, her pursuits were all defined by her love for him. That's what love does. Love defines our priorities. Defines our priorities. Defines our purposes and our viewpoints. Defines our desires. And what the world calls love today, they have no idea of what love is. Sadly, most people enter into marriage without a clue what real love is. But we need this love for the Lord if we're going to rise above the mess, if we're going to continue to rise above the mess of this world. Our love for him must cause him to be the priority in our life. He is to be the one that we drop everything for because we love him. We drop everything for him. Doesn't mean that other things aren't important. It means that our love makes him the priority. See, if you have a problem with priority, the problem really isn't with priority. The problem is with your love. That's the root problem. And that's a problem people don't want to address. Well, I'll get my priorities right. You won't unless you have a love for the Lord. I'm talking consistently. There has to be this Lord, this love. And it is this love that makes him a priority, that keeps us from having misplaced values. If I love the Lord so much that he's my priority, then my values are not going to be misplaced. It prevents misplaced loyalties. Well, I've got to be loyal to so-and-so, they're a friend, or they did this, or they did that. The Lord's the priority. No one has done more than the Lord. And you ought not love anyone more than the Lord. It is love that makes the Lord the priority that will keep us from pursuing the secondary. Keeps our priorities straight. Keeps a lot of clutter out of our life. If we love the Lord so much that he is a priority, and it will keep you ascending from the wilderness. It is this love that simplifies a life. The lives of God's people would be much more simple if they just loved the Lord more. That's a fact. If they just loved the Lord more, life would be simpler. Because it wouldn't bring in all the other garbage. Because he's a priority. This love is so, so very important. Her love for him identified her with him. Chapter 2, verse 16, she said, "My beloved is mine, and I'm his. I'm his." We can say that of our spouse. My spouse is mine and I am hers, or I am his. That doesn't belong to anyone else. And so it is with the Lord. My beloved is mine and I am his. She felt a link. She felt a bond. She felt an attachment to the Lord. And it enabled her to rise above the wilderness, because that wilderness means nothing to her. There's a togetherness. My beloved is mine and I am his. That is, we're together. We live life together. Husbands and wives are not to live lives apart. We're to live lives together. It's common ground. It's agreement. If we're going to be rising above the mess of this world, our love for him must want us to be identified with him. And if I want to be identified with him, I've got to come up out of the wilderness. I can't go further down into it. Her love for him was public. What would you think of someone, a spouse who did not publicly or was ashamed to publicly acknowledge their love for their spouse? Well, I would seriously question that love. Her love to him was public. Chapter 3 and verse 3, she said to the watchmen, which were the authorities, "Saw ye him whom my soul loveth?" She didn't even have to say who it was. They know. "Did you see him? I'm looking for him." Chapter 5, verse 8, she said to the daughters of Jerusalem, "If ye find my beloved." And again to the daughters of Jerusalem in chapter 2, verse 7, chapter 3, verse 5, chapter 8, verse 4, she referred to him in their hearing as "my love." Again, there was public acknowledgement. If we're going to be rising above the wilderness of this world, we need a love that publicly acknowledges that we love the Lord. Unashamed. Well, it might get me fired. So what? Uninhibited. To declare her love for him to others. In other words, it was a love that was openly manifested. If we're going to be rising above the mess of this world, our love for him must be openly manifested. It must be the testimony of our life. How many people know that you love the Lord? Do your neighbors know that you love the Lord? Do your family members know that you love the Lord? Have you told them that you love the Lord? You don't have to go into an explanation of why you do certain things and why you don't do certain things. It's very simple. I love the Lord. I love the Lord. Well, if I tell them that, they'll never talk to me again. So what? I love the Lord. Her love for him was one of friendship. Chapter 5, verse 16, she publicly declared, "This is my beloved." You can introduce your spouse. "This is my wife. This is my husband." And you're not ashamed to do that because of love. And you say, "This is my beloved." Pointing to the Lord, "This is my beloved." And then she went on to say, "And this is my friend." This is my friend. Husbands and wives ought to be best of friends. People say friendship and marriage don't go together. That certainly does. Your best friend in this life, other than the Lord, ought to be your spouse. And if that's not the case, your marriage isn't right. I'll just be plain and simple. This is my friend. A friend of the closest kind. My beloved. He's my friend. If you're going to be rising above the mess of this world, our love for him must make him our closest friend. If your closest friend is somewhere down in the wilderness, you're not going to continually rise above this wilderness. Your closest friend must be the Lord. And if that's so, you'll live a life ascending from the wilderness. Her love for him made him the desire of her life. She was absolutely persuaded that he was the best. That he was the best. Nothing could convince her. This world is always trying to convince us that there's something better than the Lord. You need a love that knows he's the best. There are no alternatives. He's the best. Chapter 2 and verse 3, we hear her say, "Has the ample tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons." What she is saying is, he's the best. He's the best. Chapter 5, verse 9, the daughters of Jerusalem asked her, "What is thy beloved more than another?" And she began to describe him. And she began her description by saying what he is. She said, he's the chiefest among 10,000. She says, before I give a description of him, let me tell you this, he's the best. There's nothing better. Our love for the Lord must be convinced of that. He's the best. There are some sitting here right now, you're not convinced that the Lord's the best. You never have been. And that's why you struggle with the world. If I know he's the best, I don't have to go into the world looking for something better. You see, if you go into the world looking for something better, that's not the problem. That's the symptom. The problem is you don't think he's the best. That's the problem. So we need a love that knows he's the best. There's no one better. She then gave a description of him, which shows that she was very acquainted with him there in chapter 5. And then she closes with verse 16. She says, he's altogether lovely. Oh, the world may not see him that way. But to us who love him, he's altogether lovely. There's nothing unlovely about him. So if we're going to be rising above the mess of this world, our love for him must persuade us. He's the best. He's the best. So many times, spouses go and look for someone else. Why do they do that? Because they're not convinced that he or she is the best. There's something better out there. It's dangerous ground. And it's dangerous ground when it comes to the Lord. Also, if you are not convinced that he is the best, you will fall. It's just a matter of time. You will fall. You will be sucked into the wilderness. Your life will be identified by the wilderness. But if you have this love for the Lord, He's the best. That enables you to rise above. So the foundational reason that she's able to be ascending from the wilderness, again, we're talking ongoing, continually, is that He is the love of her life. That's a root in serving the Lord. If you don't serve the Lord because you love Him, you will probably quit. If you don't dress right because you love Him, then there'll come a time when you won't dress right. You don't go to certain places because you love Him. If that's not the reason, then you will eventually go to those places. It's not mystifying. It's not a big mystery. Well, I don't understand. They know better. Well, no, they don't. They've been raised better. Well, that may be so. But it's not a mystery. The reason people quit is because there's a problem with their love for the Lord. Who is this that leaneth upon her beloved? The second thing we want to notice, and it's connected with her love, she walked with Him. Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved? They are walking together. There has to be a togetherness. This means there's an accordance, there's an agreement. And if we're going to be rising above the mess of this world, we have to be in agreement with the Lord. The reason people are in agreement with the world is because they disagree with the Lord. The world and the Lord aren't in agreement. There's no concord. So if you're in agreement with the world, you're in disagreement with God. Right. Which means you can't possibly be right. She's walking with Him. That's fellowship with Him. They're moving in the same direction. Their lives are moving in the same direction. If we're going to be rising above the mess of this world, we must be moving in the same direction as the Lord. Not only leaning, moving in the same direction, but if she's leaning upon Him, is she not also going in the same pace with the Lord? She can't be leaning up on Him if He's up there and she's back here. So not only are they walking together, they're going at the same pace. That'll keep you from going further into the wilderness. So basically what you have here is He's escorting her up from the wilderness. The Lord will always escort you above the wilderness. The Lord's not going to He's not going to escort you further into the wilderness. He's going to escort you up out of the wilderness. So all these people who are living in sin, doing things that are abominable to God, and they'll say, well, you've got to know that I love the Lord. I'm sorry, I don't know that. And the Lord did not escort you down there. If you walk with Him, you'll be coming up out of the wilderness. Then we notice her posture. She's leaning upon her beloved. She's not just walking with Him. She's leaning upon Him. That implies several truths that are necessary if we're going to continually ascend up from the wilderness. We see her leaning upon her beloved. He's real to her. You can't lean on something that's not real. You can't lean on something that's imaginary. He's visible to her. You don't lean on the invisible. You lean upon what you can see. So, he's real. He's visible. She can see him. As a result, she ascends from the wilderness. Throughout the scripture, speaking of his reality, throughout Song of Solomon, she mentions his mouth. She mentions his voice, his chambers, his table, his shadow, his banner. She mentions both his left hand and right hand. She mentions his bed, his thigh, his heart, his head, his locks, his eyes, his cheeks, his lips, his legs, his countenance, his garden, and his desire. He was real. He was real to her. You cannot, on a continuous basis, come up out of the wilderness if he's not real. If he's not real. You can believe what the Bible teaches about God. That doesn't make him real to you. He's got to be real. And if he isn't, you're going to be consumed by the wilderness. It's not if. Just a matter of time. She had personal knowledge and experience of him. If we're going to be rising above the mess of this world, he must be more than a point of doctrine. I believe very strongly that we ought to be doctrinally straight. But being doctrinally straight does not make him real. Don't confuse the two. We ought to be doctrinally straight because it glorifies God. But being doctrinally straight doesn't make you right, doesn't make Christianity real. She's leaning upon her beloved. That speaks of an awareness of his presence. She was aware of him. She leaned. And if we're going to rise above the mess of this world, we must live in the awareness of his presence. You can believe right down the line on the omnipresence of God and be ignorant of his presence. We must be aware of his presence. Must live in the awareness of that presence. The fact that she leaned upon him, does that not also imply that she was conscious of her own weakness? Keenly aware of his strength. You don't lean on something unless you know it's strong enough to hold you. You do not lean on something that's weaker than you. You lean on something because you believe this will hold me. So by leaning, she's acknowledging her own weakness. But perhaps even more importantly, she's acknowledging his strength. Leaning upon her beloved, that's a position of confidence. I'm not going to lean on something unless I'm confident that it's going to hold. It's a position of dependence. She's leaning upon her beloved. She knows the journey is long. She knows the way is perilous. She knows that she is weak and unable. So she leans upon Him. That's how you come up out of the wilderness. You lean on your own strength, you'll go further down into the wilderness. Lean upon Him. Lean upon Him. By leaning upon Him, she is strengthening herself in Him. She's experiencing Him. She's experiencing His maintaining and sustaining, keeping power. And she's getting stronger. She's experiencing His help. If we're going to be rising above the mess of this world, this must be so of us. We must lean upon Him. Experience His keeping power. She's leaning on Him. That means she's close to Him. She's near to Him. You can't lean on something across the street. You have to be near. How do you consistently rise above the wilderness? You stay near to Him. You stay near to Him. There's no other way. She's cast her weight upon Him. If we're going to consistently rise above the wilderness, we have to cast ourselves upon Him. That's how it's done. Well, again, you don't just determine from this day forward, I'm going to start coming up out of the wilderness. That may last for a few minutes, but it's not going to last. It takes love. It takes this leaning. Leaning upon Him, she's joined to Him. She's been drawn to Him. What is it that draws us? Is it what's down in that wilderness? What is it that draws us? If we love Him like we ought, He draws us. Our love for Him draws us to Him. Why does a spouse come home for work? Their love draws them to home. And our love for the Lord ought to draw us to Him. If it doesn't, then again, you have every reason to question your love. People don't like their love to be questioned. Don't give occasion for it to be questioned then. That's what I would say. She's sensitive to Him. You love somebody, you're sensitive to them. She's sensitive to Him. She's committed. She's leaning upon her beloved. She's surrendered to Him. She's actually controlled and dominated by Him. Coming up out of the wilderness, leaning upon Him. If we're going to be rising above the mess of this world, this must be so. She's leaning upon her beloved. As long as she is leaning, He has an impact upon her. When the Lord stops having an impact upon your life, upon your thinking, you are in serious trouble. You are on a path of ruin and destruction. He must have an impact upon us. Those whom we love have an impact upon us. They have an influence upon us. So the ones asking the question concerning her, who is this that cometh up from the wilderness? Leaning upon her beloved, notice, when they saw her, they saw him. When they saw her, they saw him. That ought to be true of our lives. When people of the world see us, our love for him ought to be so great that they see him. That they see him. Again, if a marriage is right, I believe two people are together. Pretty hard for two to be one if you're not together. So much so that when you go someplace without your spouse, they say, "Where is whatever your spouse's name is? Where are they?" They expect to see you with them. That's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. And when people look at us, they ought not say, "Well, where's the Lord? You used to walk with him." They see us, they ought to see him. Who is this that leaneth upon her beloved? We must be so united with him that he's noticed in our lives. This is how we come up out of the wilderness. Again, one glorious day. And we long for that day. We're going to be brought out of the mess of this world. What a wonderful day that will be. But until then, our lives are to be marked by a continuous ascending from the world. I would hope that I become stranger and more odd to the world by the day. That we do not fit in. I'll be honest, I have no, well, my flesh does, but I have no desire to fit in with this world. That's not where I want to fit in. And our greatest loves of this life should not be in the wilderness. It should be him. These are the reasons why people do not continuously ascend from the wilderness. It's because of a lack of love. He's not real to them. They're not walking with him. They're not leaning upon him. And you can be raised right. You can go to church every Sunday, every Wednesday, and if there's extra services, go then too. That doesn't make you right. What makes you right is a relationship with the Lord. And that'll keep you from falling. That'll keep you from being entangled in the world. Every day there's the dangers of being entangled. But we ought to be saying, you know what? I love the Lord too much to do that. I love the Lord too much to do that. I don't understand, well, I do, why people argue. Well, I don't see why I have to dress that way. You see, that's not even the issue. You ought to love the Lord enough to just please him. The question ought to be, would that please the Lord? If so, do it. Because you love him. Well, if I did such and such, would that displease him? That ought to always be our question. So, well, everybody else is doing that. That has nothing to do with it. Is it pleasing to God or is it displeasing to God? Oh, we need to be a people that every day are coming more and more out of the wilderness. Every day the wilderness is getting further and further into the background. But again, this is not something that you just decide tonight, you know what, I'm going to do that. You need to fall in love with the Lord. You know, Brother Clark used to say, Brother Eugene, you get a people that love the Lord, and you can teach them anything out of this book. That's true. You won't get any argument because they love the Lord. That's the foundation. And that's the root problem today, is a lack of love for the Lord. We ought to pray every day, Lord, I don't love you like I ought to. None of us do. But Lord, cause me today to love you more. Because that's the way to come up out of the wilderness. Brother Larry, if you'd come and lead us in verse 1.